some folks I used to know, used to smile and say hello. Spin the world and turn the page, entertaining from the stage. But Father Time forever true, loves its own and me and you. Disappear just like the sun when the day is done. The world is falling down, hold my hand. It's a lonely sound. Hold my hand. We'll follow the breeze and go like the wind and look for a place where the windows bend. World is falling down. Hold my hand. Hold my hand. Hold my hand. Hold my hand.
That's Abby Lincoln with "The World is Falling Down." Recorded in 1990, it was the first in a series that she did for Verve. Abby Lincoln, of course, is on vocals, Jackie McLean on alto sax, Clark Terry on trumpet, Alain Jean-Marie on piano, Charlie Hayden on bass, and Billy Higgins on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Nutrice Lead. It is Friday, March the 6th, 2015. And two topics I hope will be of interest to you today. In the second half of the program, we're going to be discussing the Edmund Pettus Bridge and our president. It is still 50 years later, and as the nation marks the anniversary, the 50th anniversary of the march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, in what is now known as Bloody Sunday, when the demonstrators advocating or seeking the affirmation of their so-called right to vote in Alabama attempted to stage a march from Selma to Montgomery and were held back and beaten back and beaten down at the site of the Edmund Pettus Bridge. President Obama is expected to be there tomorrow to mark the 50th anniversary, and I'll be talking about the symbolism of the bridge, but also the symbolism of the president's participation in this event. But first, I wanted to know whether we're still trying to locate our guest. We're having a little trouble these days with our technology, not our technology, but just picking up. And we're waiting for our guest. We'll be talking about the speech that keeps on giving. It's the gift that keeps on giving. I'm referring to Benjamin Netanyahu's speech before a joint session of Congress this past Tuesday. Prime Minister Netanyahu, in effect, delivered what could only be interpreted as a warning to the United States in his diplomacy-wrecking speech. Basically, it amounted to end all talks with Iran on its nuclear program, or don't blame Israel for taking whatever measures are necessary, or whatever measures it deems necessary, to protect itself, even peremptorily, against what he has consistently called an existential threat from Iran. The curious thing about this speech and the context of the speech is that Israel's nuclear program never does come up for debate. So I don't understand how this is working. Does Israel have a nuclear program? It is widely believed to have a nuclear program. And I'm trying to get our guest here. We were to hook up, but it's not working. Let me do this. Give us a little break, and I'll come right back and see if we can get this resolved. So we have cleared that barrier. There's an echo. So the Prime Minister's speech before Congress pretty much came with a warning or an ultimatum, depending on how you're doing. Thank you, Grant, for joining us. Grant is joining us finally. You're here. Great, great, great. We've overcome, but there's an echo in the background.
Okay, how's that?
Great. I don't want to grade you on tech skills.
No, you don't. Don't want to go there. Stay away from that topic.
Well, I'll start this again. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, in effect, delivered a warning to the United States in his diplomacy-wrecking speech before a joint session of Congress on Tuesday. In effect, it said, end all talks with Iran on its nuclear program, or don't blame Israel for taking whatever measures it deems necessary to defend itself peremptorily against Iran's existential threat. Curiously, Israel's nuclear program never has come up for discussion or debate in Congress. Our guest, Grant Smith, director of the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy, and author of several books on Israeli spying and lobbying, explains today why, whether members of Congress approved or did not approve of Netanyahu's speech, no one raises questions about Israel's nuclear arsenal or Netanyahu's role in building it. Thank you, Grant, for being with us.
Thanks for having me on. These are very important topics.
Yes, it is.
No doubt about that.
So the speech must have rung very interestingly with you, having filed a lawsuit recently. Could you tell us about that?
Sure. Just a couple of weeks before he came, the Department of Defense, after a lawsuit that we filed last fall, released a report to us, which is very unequivocal about Israel's highly advanced nuclear weapons program. The novelty of the report is that it basically benchmarks their nuclear weapons development facilities as on par with the United States facilities at Oak Ridge and some of the other national laboratories, such as Los Alamos, and it's unequivocal about the fact that in 1987 the Israelis were hard at work on hydrogen bomb development. So what's novel about this is that the U.S. government has a very corrupt policy that emerged during the Nixon administration, surprise, surprise, in which it agreed not to discuss Israel's nuclear weapons in exchange for, although this is not much of a trading good, in exchange for Israel never formally announcing that they had a program. And this is referred to as strategic ambiguity. It benefits only Israel and is a tragedy for American taxpayers. But this is a major release, and it provides the ground for a lot of potential activism.
Now, you've done quite a bit of investigative work with respect to Israel's nuclear program.
Right.
What was the reason that you filed the lawsuit?
Well, the reason is that you can't get anywhere through the Freedom of Information Act unless you go all the way to court and have the luck of the draw of a decent judge. Federal agencies are prohibited by a couple of gag orders from even discussing Israel's nuclear weapons capabilities. In fact, just last year, there was a researcher at one of the labs, one of the weapons labs, who had a small report mentioning Israel's nuclear weapons, and he was fired and had his computer searched and all sorts of punishment because there is a law, a regulation, at the Department of Energy called the Classification Bulletin WPN 136 on foreign nuclear capabilities, which prohibits any discussion. So this is why we have a bunch of mum elected officials and federal agencies, and this is why they never debated in Congress. It goes back to this corrupt Nixon deal and also additional regulations that prohibit any bona fide discussion of Israel's weapons arsenal.
You've written that Benjamin Netanyahu has a specific significance in the development of Israel's nuclear program. What is this role that
right.
he played?
We have filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the FBI because we wanted to know there was a diversion of 800 nuclear triggers in the 1970s and 80s by a man called Richard Kelly Smith with a Y. He fled overseas when he was being prosecuted for various arms export control violations. And when he came back, the FBI debriefed him, and he told them that his contacts at the Israeli front company, which was taking orders from the Ministry of Defense to run all sorts of prohibited items through this smuggling network from the United States to Israel, was none other than Benjamin Netanyahu. And so Netanyahu's speech, in which he pretends that the only proliferation problem in the Middle East is Iran, for anybody who's read his FBI file and seen his role meeting with the principals, Arnon Milchan and Richard Kelly Smith, their only response could be laughter, because he has been directly involved in smuggling nuclear triggers out of the United States.
How did this work?
Well, Heli Trading Company in Israel would take an order from the Israeli Ministry of Defense, which didn't want to use diplomatic pouches to smuggle things out of the United States. They were probably aware that those were being monitored. And so they would issue a purchase order to a company called Milco in Huntington Beach, California, run by Richard Kelly Smith. This set up with capital from Arnon Chan, the great producer, Israeli-American producer, whose recent movie Birdman is all the rage. And Smith would falsify export documents claiming that what he was shipping out, whether it was guidance systems for missiles or ballistic missile propellants or nuclear triggers, he would claim that there were other technologies, and he would falsify the export papers and then ship them out just via regular established logistics lines between the U.S. and Israel. They were caught. And since Arnon Milchan then and now is untouchable, since he's a multi-millionaire Hollywood producer, they went after the lowest guy on the totem pole, and that was Richard Kelly Smith. And he was, he has told his story, but none of the news media, since we released this in 2012, has been very interested. It doesn't really fit the narrative.
But didn't the FBI want to question Benjamin Netanyahu with respect to his alleged role in smuggling nuclear material out of the United States. When you say smuggling, were these legitimate purchases, or were these materials lifted from a stash of U.S. supplies?
No, these were not legitimate purchases. These were export prohibited items. They could not be legitimately acquired by Israel. And so when they debriefed Smith after his long sojourn overseas on the lam, they did want to know who was involved. Their most immediate target appears to have been Arnon Milchan. They assembled a huge number of clippings about his role in the smuggling operation. And he has since admitted that he has been working with Israeli intelligence virtually all his professional life. So they were more interested in Milchan, who is still in the United States and enters and leaves freely on his visa, than they were interested in Benjamin Netanyahu, apparently, who did most of his part of the deal in Israel, meeting with Smith and directing orders to the system. So there's never apparently been any big follow-up on Netanyahu.
But isn't there, I mean, there's a whole rafter of laws. I mean, this would come within, one would suspect, the purview of federal laws about smuggling nuclear materials and so forth, especially as you consider the climate of terrorism that was building even back then, and not to mention the fact that this would come under the purview of, I would imagine, the Department of Defense or the Pentagon or someplace where this is high-level crime. How did Benjamin Netanyahu manage to escape the direct purview? One would imagine coming to the United States, he would have been coming to report to the FBI to surrender.
Well, you know, unfortunately, in this country, we have an established history, and this goes all the way back to the formation of the State of Israel. The first Israeli prime minister to come to the United States, only as executive of the Jewish Agency, which was a government in waiting, was David Ben-Gurion. And when he came, he established a giant smuggling network that moved hundreds of thousands of tons of surplus World War II weapons and export prohibited items through a vast network that covered the United States to his fighters in Palestine. The Justice Department became aware of it and managed to prosecute a couple of very low-level people. But they knew who the financiers were. They knew about the money coming out of Nahum Bernstein's Jewish Agency office in New York. But because there was such a vast interconnection of campaign contributors like Abraham Feinberg that could pressure political operatives to make the Justice Department back down, the Justice Department didn't do anything. And so part of what the FBI was doing in its due diligence here, you can see who's who clippings in its FBI file on this affair, was seeing whether there was anybody who could be prosecuted or whether they're just too politically invulnerable to be worth going after. And that's pretty much the state of things right now. The Israeli intelligence networks that continue to target the U.S. are pretty much immune from any prosecution because of the domestic lobby.
Is it fair to say, let me ask you the question, since the U.S. government will not say it and has put into place all these administrative codes that are punishable, I suppose, by even prison time for disclosing whether Israel has a nuclear program. So does Israel have a nuclear program?
Well, clearly they have a nuclear program. And as Henry Kissinger once says, it appears that they even stole material for their first weapons from the United States. And that's the subject of a second lawsuit that we filed just in February. Of course they have nuclear weapons. It's clear in the historic record that virtually since the establishment of the state, they wanted the ultimate weapon for the purpose of, as Seymour Hersh has stated it, being able to threaten the entire world and have vast influence that no other country of 7 billion people has ever achieved in the world. So by being able to have this vast arsenal that can hit any capital in the world, they have a level of coercive power that is unprecedented for any nation of its size.
Where does this coercive power come from, and what is the role of AIPAC in all of this, the American-Israel political,
Public affairs. American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. Well,
you wrote a book about this. What is the role of AIPAC in all of this?
Well, AIPAC comes out of the Jewish Agency. They were originally called the American Zionist Council. They were funded by the Jewish Agency to set up a political influence network in the United States. In 1962, Kennedy ordered them to register as a foreign agent under a law, and they simply split off the lobbying division, and ever since they've been known as AIPAC. But it's a group that's very tightly coordinated with the Israeli government to exercise a huge political impact in the United States to Israel's benefit. But they're only part of a constellation of 350 other organizations set up under IRS code 501C, which move approximately $4 billion every year. If counted together, they're the largest single charity, if you want to call them that, in the United States. And they have operations all the way up from local Jewish community relations councils that vet candidates and provide members to do campaign funding for their favored candidates, who host debates, who ask questions to make sure everyone's got unfailing devotion to Israel, all the way up to, you know, organizations doing doctrine development, putting out all sorts of statements, which could never be more clear that Israel and the United States don't have the same interests, but they're devoted to pretending that they do and putting out propaganda about Iran and all of these things, and other branches that provide education and free trips to Israel for Congress members, the American Israel Education Foundation. Anyway, they're spending $4 billion a year to make sure that the United States is going to respond to Israel policy directives. And essentially, you know, this involves getting a $4.5 to $5 billion aid package, including intelligence support every year, estimated, and all sorts of other goodies from the United States, which Netanyahu alluded to when he said, you know, I've got a closer relationship to your president than any American does because I know things you don't. And it's become more and more apparent to Americans that there's this vast influence, particularly when they listen to their congressmen spouting all of these, you know, all of these catchphrases developed by the lobby.
Iran, the Iranian nuclear program, which he, of course, assails and which he demands the United States should scuttle, nonetheless is proceeding under international protocols for nuclear development. And to that degree, it's a pretty transparent process. Has Israel's nuclear program, the one that may or may not exist, has it ever come under the close scrutiny of international nuclear monitoring?
Well, they were given a reactor by the Eisenhower administration called the Sorek reactor under the Atoms for Peace program, and they built their own reactor, plutonium reprocessing reactor, with the aid of the French back in the 60s, that the Kennedy administration wanted to inspect, and when they did, sections of it were walled up and they were given a hasty tour of non-critical areas and then kicked out. And Dimona has never been internationally inspected. There was a drive to get Israel to sign the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, but and they were clearly on the track of going, you know, they were going to produce nuclear weapons, including with uranium stolen from the NUMEC facility in the United States. And so they never wanted to be part of the nuclear nonproliferation regime. What you can say is Iran's inspected program, which operates under the NNPT, is an example of the treaty's success, whereas Israel's program is an example of its biggest failure. And it goes beyond that because on the books in the United States, there are two addendums to the 1961 Foreign Assistance Act, which explicitly states that the United States cannot provide any aid to states that are operating outside the NNPT. And so it's been our position that ever since the Department of Defense confirmed the existence of the program for itself in 1987, Americans have been defrauded of more than $80 billion in aid because these two addendums to the Foreign Assistance Act were simply ignored.
How does the Obama administration, despite the fact of reported tensions, and they're so clear now, between Netanyahu and Obama, in character and in fact, in the way that the administration has responded to Israel on this question, where there are two separate kinds of rules that apply, let's say, in this case, to Iran as it does to Israel, is the Obama administration sufficiently far from the historic condescension and cooperation of the U.S. government, or is he very much in line with that kind of policy?
No, he's completely in line with the policy that, that again, disenfranchises Americans. When he was asked by reporter Helen Thomas, do you know, Mr. President, of any nation in the Middle East with nuclear weapons, he gave the entirely unconvincing answer that he didn't, quote, want to speculate on that, unquote. So he's as much involved in this campaign of deception and denial as any other previous presidents. And so, you know, what happened with Obama the moment he got into government and the Democrats had taken over, their new Justice Department dismissed a very solid espionage case against two members of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee who had stolen classified information and were attempting to use it to gin up a war with Iran. And so, you know, his administration, for all of these so-called, you know, fireworks over small protocol breaches, such as not coordinating the John Boehner Netanyahu speech on Capitol Hill, has done nothing whatsoever, and in fact has probably endangered Americans more in setting up NSA transfers of raw intelligence to the Israelis with absolutely no restrictions on it. This is data on American citizens going to Israel. This was disclosed by Edward Snowden, which allows them to snoop and target and do whatever they want to do to boost their political action at America's disadvantage. Anybody who's active in these issues should be very concerned about that. So no, I don't see any difference.
You've written six books and tons of articles about this particular subject, Israel's nuclear weapons program, and the lobby group that seems to be a juggernaut. Nobody could stand in its way. It gets exactly what it wants, even and including the interposition of a head of state over our head of state to barnstorm Congress and to basically direct its foreign policy. As a person who has been involved in this area for a long time, what to you was the most significant thing about this speech that was made on Tuesday?
I think the most significant thing about this speech was really the disingenuousness of it, and also hints that he thinks that his position is solid. Again, when he mentions speaking in code that, quote, and some of what the president has done for Israel might never be known because it touches on some of the most sensitive and strategic issues that arrive between an American president and an Israeli prime minister, unquote. This is sort of code language for saying, you know, I've got a relationship bolstered by this powerful lobby that goes above and beyond anything the American people want. I mean, if you do any real polling of Americans, and we have through Google Consumer Research done a number of them, what you find is there's a schism between what Congress is doing and what the American people think should be done. In particular, on the question of foreign aid, Israel is the destination of 9% of our foreign aid budget, more than any other country. It if you poll Americans, and we did back in September, the majority of Americans say, majority of Americans, 60.7%, say that that's too much, either much too much or too much. And so you've got this schism and this overreach in which they think that they can really get away with anything because of the lobby. But Americans are beginning to see what's going on, and that is probably the single most positive thing that's happened.
But in Israel itself, I mean, the view that is given here by U.S. media is that Israel is this monolithic group, that everybody is okay with Benjamin Netanyahu's conduct and the conduct of previous administrations, not just the personnel, but the administrative attitude of Israel has met with just wholesale approval. And that is not the case at all.
No, it's not the case. And again, that's the overreach, and that is the problem. And fortunately, with social media and enhanced communication networks, people don't have to be subjugated to just a propaganda bombast saying that there's this huge special relationship of immense benefit to the U.S. Where the benefit is never explained clearly, the costs are never explained. So I do think with the advent of the internet and the ability of people to get information from other sources that aren't completely dominated by the usual suspects like Dennis Ross and other luminaries of the lobby who are, you know, basically lying about just about everything, and getting other voices that know something about the region, I think it's been of tremendous help. And it's one of the reasons, you know, Americans don't want to support this project anymore.
Could we talk about your organization and what it has been doing consistently for a number of years and where it is you're going next?
Yeah, sure. Well, we started in 2002. By 2003, we were hosting a forum in the Rayburn House office building of Congress, in which we were debunking all of the reasons being put forward to invade Iraq. And the program is to see what are the true drivers of U.S. policy, whether they represent a wider U.S. interest, that is, the interests of the American voter. And if they don't, to find out, you know, how to take a better, more closer look at you could call it deconstructing them. And so we've done that through a number of, as you say, mentioned, the books, the web reports, the news releases, gatherings, whether they're on Capitol Hill or at the National Press Club, major events, trying to help people who have solid analysis that is being undermined or not adequately distributed, and the lawsuits. When you force the government in front of a judge and in front of the American public to fight to keep secret information that is so obviously overdue for the public domain, fighting to keep corrupt policies in place, it really puts the government in territory they don't want to be. And you can start convincing people, I think, to withhold their consent. And there are a lot of ways to do that. Withhold their consent from the U.S. government for these policies in very effective ways. But we've only begun to do that.
How can people learn more about the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy?
Well, you can come to our next conference at the National Press Club. That's going to be on April 10, 2015, all day. You can register for that at IsraelLobbyUS.org, or you can watch the videos that come out. A day later, you can go to the IRMEP.website, sign up for our podcast, sign up for our email bulletins. You can go through all of the reports about what the Israel lobby is doing in the United States as a key policy driver at IsraelLobby.org. And, of course, you can always send us money if you like doing that, because that's one of the things we run on, not just, you know, peanut butter sandwiches and bananas. So there are a whole host of things people can do to support this, and we'd certainly like to see as many people as possible come to our conference. Those are great events, great learning events, very high-profile things.
Thank you very much, Grant Smith, for being with us and for managing to overcome technology today. You win the gold star.
You're not going to let that go. Thank you, Keith.
Thank you. Thanks so much. That's irmep.org is the address. You can go there, the website. You can take a look at what they've been doing, and you certainly can learn more about the Israel lobby and also about Israel's undeclared nuclear program. We'll take this break and come back and talk about a bridge right after this. On Sunday, March the 4th, 2007, then-presidential hopeful Senator Barack Obama of Chicago had a great photo op. He joined marchers commemorating Bloody Sunday by crossing the Edmund Pettus Bridge. On March the 7th, 1965, about 600 protesters were about to start a march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama, the state's capital, to demand voting rights and protection of their voting rights. State troopers and local police, however, met them at the bridge and violently attacked them. President Obama now will join thousands planning to converge at the bridge to mark the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday. And so it is a very interesting and symbolic opportunity here to understand where we are. For President Obama, it was the bridge was a symbol of his own historical trek from senator to president. But what does it mean for the rest of us? This bridge, the Edmund Pettus Bridge, named after a Confederate general who also happened to have been a grand dragon of the Ku Klux Klan, still stands as a badge of slavery to remind African Americans in Alabama just where they are, just where they stand in the scheme of things. And you wonder, after 50 years, you know, not even that progress caused the name of the bridge to be changed. It still stands as a reminder of where black folks are and where they stand in the great southern state of Alabama. But this, too, is an opportunity to take a look at the slow pace of progress. And, of course, I'm particularly peeved, I must say, about the propensity of this president, when it comes to African Americans, his core, one would believe, his core constituency, because it was the core constituency of his success for his first election and again for the second. Whether he deserved it or not is a whole other question, but African Americans remain the core. In crossing that bridge, would they be able to say tomorrow that they have crossed that divide of two Americas, separate and still unequal? I don't think so. Not even with an African American president. And where he is concerned, particularly, and I've pointed this out several times, he tends to be symbolic with respect to African Americans, but substantive to the rest of the world. He knows he has to deliver concrete things to those constituencies and sees to it that he does. But on every important index by which progress is measured, can we say that this president who trekked across the bridge as a presidential hopeful and tomorrow could cite his progress, a progress basically that was caused to happen for him, could he really say that he has delivered for that constituency that brought him along? It's a kind of an inside joke in a way. I'm with you, but just symbolically. This is the same president who stood in the shadow of Lincoln. You recall last year when I went bananas about it. On the occasion of the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, and what he said to the assembled crowd was that the road ahead is long and hard. Well, we know what that means. Don't look to me to solve your problems. I'm not the one. Look ahead. I'm here to just let you know what ahead looks like. Not now. The possibilities and your hopes and dreams and aspirations are not to be linked to me. I'm here to assure you that my great vision allows me to inform you about what the road ahead, that is outside of my purview, looks like. And it's more of the same. Besides which, you're conditioned to be long-suffering people. So the road ahead looks long and hard. And he was making this address. He was telling these people this offensive thing, not only 50 years after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, but close to 238 years after waiting for that long time just to vote. But the road ahead is long and hard. And his administration has taken that as a kind of credo. We had the U.S. Attorney General, the soon-to-be ex-U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, embodying this spirit and mindset by telling people, in effect, don't look to me to solve your police brutality issue. Because the federal standard is so high that we can't possibly even begin to think about going after an errant police officer, a rogue cop, because, well, federal statutes are way too high. Not that my will is low or my capacity or my concern is a bit lower than it ought to be, but that the standards are high. So temper your enthusiasm for justice. What's going to be the thought of people crossing that bridge? And it's all going to be wrapped up in symbolism, Because 50 years ago, there were these white cops and state troopers with billy clubs and tear gas and dogs. But that does sound familiar, doesn't it? It should sound familiar to you, because yesterday we heard about billy clubs and dogs in Ferguson 50 years later with a black president and a black state attorney general. And they all are very, very symbolically tied to the Edmund Pettus Bridge, named after the Grand Dragon Edmund Pettus. So, you know, you think about these things and it becomes a kind of surreal experience, because you wonder whether people's brains are working and whether they're making connections, these essential connections, in evaluating where we actually are in the here and now. 50 years, half a century has gone by. And we are still encouraged to hold on to this psychological baggage that we just can't seem to jettison. That somehow we were kind of divinely ordained to suffer so. Long-suffering people, we suffer so well. We're so good at it. And we will gather for 50 years to talk about the symbolism of 50 years ago rather than the substance of now. What is the substance of now? What do we show for every step those people will be taking across that bridge? What can we show, the definitive proof of progress? What can we show as the advantages of having progressed to the point where you have a black president, a black U.S. Attorney General, all these African-American leaders, and what is the substantive proof of progress? By any measure, take any index, employment, education, housing, safety, health care, food, shelter. You take any of these things, these basic things, and can we say definitively, as each step is made across that bridge, that you can tick off on a long enough sheet of paper all the good things that have been realized, and especially so under African-American leadership? I'm sure there are about three or four or five things that you can find, but I'm talking about in aggregate, as a society, as a whole. How have we progressed from the battles that were being waged back then and before then to now? And it has to be a painful exercise, I'm sure, because nobody really enthusiastically embraces this kind of thing, because we know what the truth is. The truth is we can't point to much. We can't point to much at all. But we are still married to the symbolism of it, as if the symbolism is itself a reality, and it isn't. Like I said, 50 years and not even the name of the bridge has been changed. The badges of slavery still remain in your face, reminding you that this indeed is America. Actually, two Americas, one white, one black, separate and unequal. But it is a safe thing to deal with symbolism because people get it's first of all, it makes great TV, good pictures. And that's why the senator hoping to be president, Barack Obama, found himself there in the first place. It's great symbolism. Oh, I was there. Were you there on the bridge? Oh, I was there. I was there. As if that's enough. What have you done is the question. And what are you doing to honor those who were there? Because when they showed up when they answered that call to duty at the Edmund Pettus Bridge 50 years ago, it was not for a photo opportunity. It was not to make the evening news. They were fighting literally for basic rights. And that is just another link in the long chain of struggle in this country by black people for just basic rights. And there are pictures to show you. Klansmen in full regalia crossing their bridge. It's named after their man. No problem. But when they showed up for duty that day, when they answered the call of duty that day, the black folks were not interested in photo ops. This was not a thing. This was not a social event. This was not for autographs. Or to say, look, there are pictures of me on the bridge, so I had to have been there, and because I was there, it means I'm with you. That's not why they showed up. They were fighting. They were fighting and were brutally attacked by the state. And that was 50 years ago, and 50 years later, they're still fighting. And is still being brutally attacked by the state. And yet, there are those who are crossing that bridge tomorrow who would tell you about the great progress we have made. And we have made great progress because I used to be a senator, now I am a president. Therefore, we have made great progress. And there are people thick-headed enough to believe that as true. That's how we're supposed to measure progress. That we have one billionaire, we have one of everything that whites like. Therefore, we have made progress. So I suggest to you that tomorrow, when the news programs show the great symbolic march, and that's all it is, because we know the reality of our condition is that we know we have no power, or the power that we have is mostly latent and dormant. We don't have the guts in our leadership to exercise our power. So we settle for symbolism because we know there is no substance. So that march across the bridge tomorrow is yet another photo op, yet another act of symbolism. But the real champions perhaps are mostly dead and gone. We have fallen down on the job big time, and we are now in a kind of surreal world where the things we place emphasis on, the things that we value, have absolutely nothing to do with our condition. They're all silly stuff, all fluff. They're symbolic gestures that do not translate to anything real. And we keep this going. Perhaps it's a measure of how debilitated we are, how psychologically vanquished we are, that we accept this and become to regard symbolism as substance. I wish we would wake up. I wish we would wake up. And if nothing else reminds us as how far we still have to go, is that tomorrow we will still have to remind ourselves that this bridge is still called the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And the president will have assembled with perhaps thousands of other people, oblivious to the irony of it all, that they are affirming imaginary rights attained with the backdrop of the reality of their condition, assembling on a bridge named after a Confederate general who also was a grand dragon of the Ku Klux Klan, and he has outlasted them in the battle for domination. Well, that brings me to the end of the program today. Of course, you noted that we did not have our regular Free Your Mind Friday. We will make up for everything when we are fully back. They're working very, very hard at PRN to get the innards of the station back together after two pretty sizable setbacks, I must say. But the thing is that there's movement, and in the real sense of the word, too, the offices are being moved and being reassembled. So we are basically doing our basic kind of technological programming. We'll get through. So bear with us. But by next week, I know, and you know, we will have to do a lot of makeup. So we'll do a lot of kissing and making up next week, hopefully, and we will get to relate to each other the way we do, with back and forth conversation. And we will do that and make up for the time that we have lost with each other. But I want to thank you so much for your continued encouragement and your patience and, of course, your love and respect. Stay tuned. Keep it right here. Richard Martin is next with Wake Up Call. You could reach me at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Until then, have a decent weekend with yourself. Rest up a little bit. Take it easy. And always a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.